Hey, it's Mark Pattison back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And this week, I interview a guy named Major Joshua Mance. And I've done a lot of pretty incredible stories on amazing people overcoming whatever their adversity is. But this was really emotionally charged and heartfelt. Imagine this. You're in Iraq and you're on a patrol and your buddy gets hit by a sniper fire, which goes through his heart, out his back, and into your knee, which was the case of Joshua Mance. And a 19-year-old medic has the quick decision to save only one. Who's that going to be? So Joshua ultimately ends up flatlining for 15 minutes. And we go into heavy-duty depth about what that's like to feel like death is coming upon you. And then did he see the white light? And what happened after that? And as you can imagine, there was about 10 years of this emotional struggle that he had to go through on so many different levels. And so it's just a riveting episode, and I really encourage you to hang in there and see it through. This guy is amazing. He's a deep thinker, and it was so rewarding for me. So totally appreciated on that. And as always, go in, rate, review on iTunes. I will have some shout-outs going forward for people who do those ratings and reviews. It really does help elevate us in the right way. And as always, if you want to know what's going on with my climbs coming up on May 23rd, Denali trying to tag at the top once again. Last year, pushed back by minus 60 degree weather. Not fun. So I have to do the whole thing again. So I've been in intense training here in Sun Valley, Idaho. And you can also find out more about what's going on my website, markpattisonnfl.com. Public speaking. I'm out there telling the story of how I had to overcome my adversity to move on and get to where I am today. Okay, so on that note, let's go talk to Joshua. Here we go. Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit. And certainly this will be the case of this person, Joshua Mance, who's overcome some serious stuff. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Mark. How's everything going on your end?
It's going great. I am broadcasting live from Sun Valley, Idaho, my new spot. I'm doing these podcasts, and you're in San Jose, California. How's it going up there?
It's good. We've got a little bit of weather coming through today, which is kind of nice. So California's been getting a decent amount of rain this year.
Yeah. You know, the day I actually left California, Hermosa Beach to be exact, it was just an absolute deluge of water coming down. And one day you don't want it to rain. Of all the days it doesn't rain, it suns out there. That was the day. So I left California in a rainy spot and I land in Sun Valley, Idaho, and it's sunny. It seems like every day, 300 days a year, is pretty sweet.
Right on.
So, hey, let's get into this. Your story is just absolutely fascinating, and I want to do a little bit of into thin air type storytelling here where the author actually start off where they're at like 27,000 feet and all hell is breaking loose, and then they back it up from there in terms of what happened and how all those guys on Everest came to be part of that tragedy up there. But in your case, I was reading a lot about your background and your history, but you served in the Iraq War, okay? And you were in a situation where you were shot and you actually were clinically dead for 15 minutes, correct?
That's correct.
That's just unbelievable. So we're going to stop it right there as kind of a teaser. And I want to go back to kind of what led you to sign up and go and protect our country and end up in that war. And then we'll just go through all this stuff. So where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Sunbury, Pennsylvania, which is a small town in northeast Pennsylvania. And to kind of fast forward, two very influential people in my life growing up through high school. One was my stepfather, who's a police officer and former infantry officer in the Army as well. And the other was recently retired Special Forces Sergeant Major, who had a huge impact in high school and really kind of took me under his wing. And he's the one that really got me to internalize at a very young age the capacity, the power of the human spirit, irrespective of culture or where you live in the world. It is like never underestimate the human spirit. So he deeply ingrained the values of, or the importance of understanding language, understanding culture, demonstrating respect for people from a variety of settings. And that proved just invaluable. After graduating high school, I went to West Point, and 9/11 happened my freshman year at the academy. Just 50 miles away from us is West Point's in New York, just north of New York City. So that drastically changed the tone of the entire Corps of Cadets, of the entire academy. And it prompted my decision to major in Arabic at that time, because I knew I'd be on the ground as an infantry officer.
How difficult is that language to pick up?
It's pretty brutal. To a native English speaker, there's a couple of languages that are kind of, they're called like tier four languages, which means they're kind of the hardest to acquire for a native English speaker because they're so different. Arabic is one. I think the others are Chinese, Japanese, Korean, down to like level one languages would be like Spanish, right? So it's an interesting language, phonetic alphabet, 28 letters written right to left. And what's interesting is that it operates on this root system. So every word can basically be deduced down to three letters. And that letter carries a general connotation, a general meaning. All the characters that you add in between those letters basically shift and mold the meaning of the word. And that's kind of what you spend your life trying to figure out, how to assess that very quickly.
And how long does that take for you to learn, at least get somewhat proficient where you can communicate with others?
Quote unquote, being fluent in a language is a very fluid term. When I left West Point, I was like, okay, I could get by on basic conversations. And fortunately, that's predominantly what's needed to establish trust with people, right? They're not looking for you to have a master of the language. They're looking for you to have the respect to attempt, right, speaking to them in their language. So that was invaluable. But 3 years at the academy studying it, year and a half in the Middle East, being immersed in it, and then later in my career going to the Defense Language Institute for a really robust year and a half. And it wasn't until that point that I came out like pretty fluent.
So let's go back to your high school for a minute. So obviously you did well enough to get into West Point. So as you're looking at the landscape of colleges out there, and you've probably had some different choices that you could go in wherever you're looking at that time, was it those mentors that kind of shaped you in terms of, this is the path that I want to go down?
Yep. It was my stepfather. I can actually point to a specific time when I was probably about 12 years old, where I was this conflicted little kid, right? I wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to be a good student. I wanted to go to the military. And he kind of planted the seed in my mind that day and then said, well, you know, if you go to one of the academies, you can do all three at the same time. And from that point forward, I was laser focused on making it in.
So did you play sports in college, academy?
Kind of the deal with all of the academies, including West Point, is every cadet is an athlete of some kind. So whether you're playing D1 sports or intramurals, which are very competitive there, because as a collective, it's probably one of the fittest schools in the nation as a whole. But yeah, I did a lot of boxing and mixed martial arts when I was there predominantly.
Yeah, that's cool. So just to kind of relate that story, my dad was an Air Force pilot. And when I was in high school, I was probably, of all the schools that came after me to recruit, probably the heaviest and most hardcore was from the Naval Academy in Colorado Springs. Really? And my dad finally had to step in. I was like, Dad, I'm not sure about this. And he was great about just really helping guide me. But honestly, I don't think I was mature enough to go and take that on, where you're going through boot camp and square meals and things and the kind of requirement and commitment. My dad was not a hardcore military guy, nor did he press me. I'm not saying that your stepdad did that to you, but I just had other choices, and I was kind of chasing the shiny object, which at that time was the University of Washington and great football program. And so it just seemed like that's the path I want to go to versus going through and making that kind of commitment. And it sounded to me too, is like, it, once you went through, it was kind of a 4-year commitment. And then if you went in and you want to be a Top Gun pilot or something, there was another 5 years. So as an 18-year-old, I was looking at essentially a 9-year commitment. And I just didn't have the maturity at the time, 17, 18, to kind of think that far out.
Right. To be clear, like, nothing wrong with that, right? It takes everybody to make the world work. And there's so many different paths to approach it. And sure enough, years and years and years later, here we are on this podcast, right? The academy is kind of it's an animal. You kind of step on that train and shortly after graduating high school, and it's not till 4 years later where you get off and you're kind of wondering what just happened. It's like a blur. You don't really realize how much it transforms you until much later in your career. And in our cases, that was started to become noticeable in combat.
I remember where I was sitting the day that 9/11 happened, and I was in my house in Seattle, and I got a call actually from a guy I was working with in Hong Kong, and he goes, "Hey, have you seen the TV?" And I go, "No," and I turned it on. And we obviously, in our lifetime, my lifetime at least, have never been attacked, right? And so this is my experience of just seeing this horrific thing go down in New York City and Washington, D.C., and I can only imagine what that would be like if you're now in some form of military school or you're a veteran or something, and you just having that those feelings of being like amplified 10x from just the normal person sitting there just like, what in the world is going on? And so it would make sense to me. I've heard a lot of stories from a lot of guys. That was the motivation, that they wanted to sign up. They want to get involved. They want to do what they could do to go over there and solve the problem and get back. And it sounds like there was something in you that triggered that you wanted to get involved.
Before that I was already in the academy, right? It happened during our freshman, like just after getting there. The most difficult part about the entire four-year experience of the academy was just staying at the academy after 9/11 happened.
But at the same time, the war is going on. So as all you guys and your classmates, as you guys were there, were you kind of gearing up towards this? You knew you were going to head to Iraq?
That's what I mean about it being difficult. It took everything that I had to not drop out of the academy, enlist, and go fight the fight downrange with the larger team. It was very difficult feeling stuck, imprisoned almost in an academic environment when some of your best friends in the larger military is out fighting this main effort fight in the Middle East. And it's not this lust for war or anything like that. It's really just an underlying sense of very, very powerful guilt that you want to be there to support your team and part of that main effort, and to be stuck writing history reports when your best friend's getting killed, which happened in my case, was that was the hard thing, was to just stay at the academy, kind of have faith in the process.
So we're going to get into some of this emotional stuff a little. I want to dig in further, but is there, in this particular case of what you're talking about, is there some kind of emotional guilt that you're not with your bros over there side by side fighting the fight next to them?
I think that's kind of a universal factor amongst people in the service professions, at least to some degree, right? When your teammates, your comrades are in harm's way, there's a lure to be beside them at a minimum, right? And there's a lure to do your part, even if it seems irrational at a distance. Because when negative events happen, right, which could be a variety of different things, but when there's an event that happens that produces a negative result, there's a lot of determinants of guilt that can factor in to driving us to do more or drive our underlying sense of responsibility that we perceive for that event. Guilt is a very complex emotion for a lot of these reasons that I'm just barely touching on right now, but it's definitely a huge factor.
Is the motivating factor for you to stay in the academy versus like, you know what, those guys are over there, I want to go join those guys, I'm out of here, is that when you do enter, rather than just go in and enlist, you just enter at a much higher level in terms of responsibility and leadership when you stay with the academy?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, maybe I can relate. You know, you mentioned football, right? It's almost like, imagine the anxiety you feel before you step on the field and the game kicks off.
Yeah.
Right? It's almost easier to be in the game, to be in the fight, right, than it is to be gearing up to go.
Yeah.
And there's almost like this space, this gap that exists that needs to be filled in order to be able to satisfy that drive, right? It's grounded in camaraderie. It's not grounded in like a lust for combat. It's something I think is important to clarify.
So now you graduate and now you're headed towards Iraq, right? From a layman's perspective, I've obviously never been to the Middle East. What is that like when you land there? What are you looking at? Is it rubble everywhere? Does it look like it's 2,000 years behind everything? Or is it a lot of Baghdad and surrounding communities are fairly modern? What's that like?
It depends on where you are. We were in Baghdad, which was a pretty modern city. In our part of eastern Baghdad, it was very war-torn, very disrupted, because all the existing government structures were depleted or gone. You know, lots of bombed-out buildings, lots of displaced Shia Muslims in our area. It was predominantly a Shia district. So lots of mud huts and stuff that people would craft out of garbage and trash in order to live in was really the norm in that area. No sewage systems, no electricity, so raw sewage running through the streets. You can imagine taking a big city, right, and taking away the sewage systems, taking away the electricity, taking away all the most fundamental needs of life, food, water, air, shelter, electricity, trash removal. all of that's gone, a wartime environment, right? And people, I strongly believe that wherever you go in the world, people are just people, right? Same underlying needs and desires. And despite all the hype in the media about extremists, it's quite overblown. We have, in any society, you have a very small percentage of people who disrupt status quo, right? In this case, I'm talking about insurgents who rape, torture, kill, pillage in order to gain power over the population. But the bulk of the people are just people, right? The bulk of the people just want to live and let live. They want their kids to be able to go outside and play soccer without being blown up by a mortar round.
Yeah.
So it was really, in a large sense, this human spirit kind of emerging in whatever way it could. People trying to get back to the life that they once knew. It was a very chaotic environment, right? You remember all these government structures that many of us tend to take for granted because we never lived in the absence of them.
Yep.
Are not there. Police forces there are not respected. For the most part, completely ineffective. Largely, their military was the same way at that time. I'm better now. So it's this very, like, almost reduction to back to this almost tribal kind of society in many ways as they sought to rebuild those government structures and establish the leaders that were necessary to take them to the next level.
What role did you have when you landed in Iraq?
So I was a platoon leader of an infantry platoon and then later a scout platoon, which is basically a team of about 40 people in this type of environment. You know, this is true insurgency, counterinsurgency warfare. It's asymmetrical warfare. It is not the archetypal warfare images that many of us have in our minds of World War II, Battle of the Bulge, force on force.
Yeah.
It's anything but that. And the counterinsurgency environment is actually considered to be the graduate level of warfare because of its complexity. We must retain our tactical expertise always and be able to turn that switch on in a second if we need to. But the essence of the entire operation is grounding and building relationships with the local population. So many of the responsibilities that we had, and most of us had to learn this on the fly, went far beyond military tactics, right? We had to learn how to be city mayors and politicians and economists and engineers and try to kind of be a jack of all trades to enhance the dynamics of the entire city. We had to learn and understand the cultures. We had to learn and understand the language, right? Which is why the language training was so critical.
Sure.
That ended up being the most powerful weapon that I carried was the ability to speak Arabic.
It would seem to me that, again, a guy back here in the States, you know, just observing and listening to you, that it would give me a lot of anxiety to doing all the things you just talked about. And really that boils down to that little word called trust, right? And so you're trying to bridge that trust between Iraqis and they're not sure exactly what we're up to. And at the end of the day, you just don't know who's going to pull that gun or I don't know. It seemed like I'd be walking on eggshells a lot as I'm going around the corner and just you don't know what's behind that door.
The enemy in this environment doesn't wear uniforms.
Yeah.
Right? And it's so important to kind of try to understand and appreciate the complexity of this, which we could talk for hours about it, right? But in this environment, the armed insurgents that you might hear about on news channels or the media, the folks who are firing the rocket-propelled grenades or the folks who are setting off the roadside bombs, they are the tip of the iceberg. Right. And it's very much an iceberg theory that the visible insurgents, the visible people who are participating in the actual guerrilla tactical actions, that's just the very tip. In truth, everything underlying that iceberg is an entire shadow government as that insurgency develops. You know, everything that what funds that insurgent to go and put that bomb on the side of the road, somebody has to make it, right? Somebody has to manufacture it, somebody has to transport it. There's got to be sales, there's got to be financial capabilities, there's got to be propaganda, there's got to be recruiting capability. Everything goes into this that go into a typical political government structure, but it's done in the shadows, right? So much of this wasn't understood by many of the people who were fighting this conflict, this effort, because it was kind of such a new, I don't want to call it a new concept. Counterinsurgency, insurgency has been around for a long time throughout history. But it's the memory of the organization, right? The memory of the military has for a long time been grounded in conventional operations. So we had to relearn on the fly how to just completely adapt everything that we thought we knew and put it into action.
Bring me up to the day that you got injured.
Yeah, so this was one of the main responsibilities that I had was to develop a strong relationship with the Iraqi police forces in our area. To help them basically establish a presence and start to take over their own operations, right? we don't want to be there years and years on end, right? With the local population to take care of themselves. So it's very important that this joint effort between the Iraqi police and our American forces was visible to the public, right? And after months of work, after months of talking with the police chief in Arabic, I actually convinced him to go on a patrol with us outside of his normal sector, which was pretty amazing. But we left, and this was in April of 2007.
And had you gone on this route yet? Had you gone outside these limits?
I had personally been there with my unit once, and it was a very dangerous kind of patrol. There was a reason why we picked this area, and it was a humanitarian mission. Right. So we were running up there to try to develop a relationship with the people in this area because it was kind of strategic in a lot of different ways, small, but strategic. And to do that, the first time I was out there, we recognized there were some needs, like that they needed clothes, they needed basic supplies, school supplies, stuff like that. So this was just the first attempt to enhance that relationship and kind of deliver on a promise, which is how you start building trust. So we did this patrol, it went without a hitch. Later, we got diverted to another part of the area, and that's when we were engaged by an enemy sniper. You know, and the bullet severed the aorta of my senior non-commissioned officer and then ricocheted into my thigh and severed my femoral artery. And from that point forward, the fight for my life kind of began.
So when that happens in your case, the blood is just flowing, and you got to stop that thing like ASAP, right? Or you're going to bleed out.
Yeah, at that point, with both a severed aorta, a severed femoral, they're kind of two of the worst injuries you can have. I had a 19-year-old medic who was on the ground that day.
Yeah.
And he had to make a very conscious, very immediate choice about who he was going to try to save and who was going to die. He couldn't save both of us. We both had less than 2 minutes to live.
Yep.
And he had a fraction of a second to make that decision. So he chose to try to save me because I had a slightly better chance of survival than did Marlon. And although that was the right choice, although he performed brilliantly that day, the whole team did. You know, one of the most amazing things about this is I was conscious through the whole experience. From the time I got shot to the time I took my very last breath and flatlined about a half an hour later, to be able to witness these teams operating in the face of crisis, it was just phenomenal. Again, you know, I go back to that power of the human spirit. It was almost like watching a choreographed dance when I got to the initial aid station, the initial hospital.
Yeah.
A phenomenal experience just to witness that. I know that may sound weird given that I'm this whole experience here. What's interesting about it is, as interesting as this story is, right? And I get that it took a very long time for me to realize that it wasn't this experience that was really the emotionally traumatic part of the totality of the last 10 years, right? This experience in isolation really wasn't the crux of it. It was everything before, everything afterwards, which is a whole other story. But this process of dying for some of the reasons I'm highlighting right now was actually one of the most positive experiences of my life, with the exception, of course, of losing Marlon.
Did you have any survivor's guilt at all? I can only imagine, you know, you and your buddy are in that truck and all of a sudden you guys get hit. And so everything is just happening. Boom, 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 boom. It's just like rapid fire and people are running and yelling and all these things are going on in your head. And so I'm sure there isn't at that point moment, it wouldn't seem like you're just trying to hold on, like figure it out and like what's going to happen here. And then boom, it's all rushing towards you. But somewhere at any point in time in your journey, do you look back and like, why me?
That's a great question. The survivor's guilt question is a great question. And it's an important one to talk about for a minute. Might help if I kind of set the conditions for this answer, because guilt is such an extremely complex emotion that most of us, when we think survivor's guilt, right, we think, in my case, the fact that Marlon died and I lived would indicate that I should have survivor's guilt over that. And that seems so obvious on the surface. And that's what most people in my life pointed to. Because I couldn't tie it to anything else, I couldn't understand the complexity of it, right? And this is the essence of the last 10 years. This is the essence of the book, The Beauty of a Darker Soul, is to help understand these things at a much deeper level. Because I had nowhere else to point, I almost forced myself to start to believe that there should be something wrong, that I should be feeling survivor's guilt, that everything emotionally that I was experiencing should be surrounding this event. And I'm not negating that didn't have an impact at all, right? But when we look at trauma, what is emotional trauma? And the way I define emotional trauma, it's an experience or a situation that fundamentally alters the way we believe the world should work, right? And when our perception of the world gets flipped upside down, it can impact the way we feel about ourselves, right? To varying degrees. in the case of what happened in this specific incident, you know, and trauma is very relative, right? Like my experience, you and I could go through very similar events, and this may have a devastating impact on you and not on me, or vice versa, right? It's all relative for a lot of reasons. So I'm not minimizing this at all. But what I am saying is that in my case, like I knew that something like that could happen. We all did. Everything we did that day was tactically as perfect as it could have been. And honestly, I think it actually helped that I died with Marlon, even though I got back. I dragged him out of the way basically until I passed out. I think that kind of somehow helped relinquish guilt before it even took hold. The difference, and I'll tease this out, everything, virtually everything that I ultimately uncovered, all of the emotional pain, the emotional turmoil, everything over the last 10 years was driven by guilt. Just not necessarily in the form of survivor's guilt as we just assumed. The guilt that I experienced, for example, this is just one facet of it. When I was evacuated to Walter Reed Army Medical Center after I was shot, Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. is basically the biggest hospital in the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. They send all the most severely wounded service members to heal. And physically, the care that I received there was phenomenal, like nowhere else that I would rather be. But emotionally, it's a very difficult place to be because you're surrounded by the worst of the worst injuries, amputees, burn victims.
It's hard.
And as bad as my injury was, I was one of the only ones in that entire hospital that was expected to make a full recovery. Mm-hmm. And in fact, did. I went back to Baghdad 4.5 months later voluntarily. But in that, the image while I was there that I'll never forget is I walked around a corner and I saw this beautiful blonde girl in her early 20s pushing around her new double amputee fiance in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And it's just an image that riveted me. So the guilt that I was experiencing was a guilt in my ability to heal when others couldn't.
That makes a lot of sense to me. One of the things that you said is that should be pointed out, it's all relevant to your situation, right? Mm-hmm. Because everybody's situation is at a different level, from people not being injured to people who are injured. I mean, it's amazing on this podcast I've talked to, it's about finding your summit, about overcoming adversity and finding your way. And I've talked to people with no arms, no legs, or blind, can't hear. I mean, it's all relevant to your situation in the way that you're able to deal with that and those things. I would also ask the question, we don't need to talk about it, but I'd also ask the question to that 19-year-old faced with that decision, which way do you go, right? And you either go right or you go left, and somebody's going to make it and somebody's not. And for him, and what kind of weight that would have been. My first experience with this was, as it relates to kind of survivor guilt, was about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, and I was invited to Steve Young, the quarterback for the 49ers. I was invited to a ski event that he was having, a charity event that he was having down at Snowbird. And so myself and other NFL guys showed up, and Dick Bass, the owner of the hotel, who's the guy that had originally pioneered the seven summits, the whole, I'm going to climb the highest peaks on every continent, he came up to and joined us at this table. And about a month before, he and his best friend, Frank Wells, who was the president of Disney, had gone up and they were going to go heli-skiing. And they had a great day. They were with their wives. They had taken two helicopters. And some bad weather was starting to come in, and so they decided to cut the trip short. And so Dick and Frank Wells had rode up in the helicopters together, and the wives had ridden up in the helicopters together. And right before they're about to take off and go down the mountains, as the weather, bad weather is coming in, Frank Wells' wife comes over and knocks on the door and says, "Hey, do you mind if I ride with my husband down the mountain? I just feel more comfortable about that." And so he has no problem. So he jumps out of the helicopter, goes over to the other helicopter where his wife was. Both helicopters take off. And as they're going down the mountain, the helicopter with Frank Wells, the Disney CEO, crashes. Everybody in the plane dies.
Wow.
And so he's telling the story at the table, sobbing. He owned Snowbird. We're in his hotel up there. And he's in front of, there's probably 10 of us. And he was having such a hard time coming to grips of, why me, right? And he's since passed about a year or two ago, but it was just very emotionally charged, and he just fell for the guy, and like it all had to do with chance and luck and some other things. So anyways, that's on that story. So, okay, so now you're shot, you pass out after a couple minutes, and now they rush you off to this makeshift hospital, whatever you want to call this, this mass unit. And at the end of the day, you actually literally flatline, but something that I heard you say in a TED Talk was that you could feel yourself dying. And I've never asked this question because I've never asked the question. I've never known anybody that has flatlined and come back. Like, how did you know you were dying? I mean, what is that feeling? Are you starting to like lose it, or I don't know what that means.
That's a good question. So in this context, I was dying of blood loss, obviously from a severed femoral artery. So almost all of the blood in my body had drained. It was amazing that I was still staying conscious. But when you're dying of blood loss, you're essentially suffocating. And there's nothing to deliver oxygen to the vital organs of the body, right? And what happens is the body in that situation will actually pull blood to the chest cavity in order to protect the vital organs. I could actually feel that happening. Like the blood would creep out of my extremities, and as all the blood left, they cramped up and became numb. And then that blood creeping sensation would move closer and closer to my core, and it would become numb. And when that feeling hit my stomach, that was the first point where I realized the injury was getting out of control. Physically, at that point, it felt like I was running sprints around a track and just couldn't stop. Like, imagine you're doing the toughest workout of your life, just breathing fire, but you just can't stop, right? That's kind of what it felt like.
Yeah.
And just kind of gasping for air. And emotionally, this is when it started to change. We're probably about a minute now from the point of death, but emotionally, I started, and life didn't flash before my eyes, right? But I do believe what was most important to me was revealed in those final moments. And that is that suddenly, without trying to, I started to repeat three names in my head over and over again for the last minute of my life. That was my mom and my two sisters. Mm-hmm. That blood creeping sensation continued towards my chest cavity. And when it hit there, I consciously knew that that was it.
Yeah.
Took my last breath, said my last thought, and died. Often get the question, what was that like? Was there white light? Was it an out-of-body experience? In short, that answer is no. To date, yet, I haven't been able to access kind of what happened during those 15 minutes.
Yeah.
However, what I did experience, I think, was even more powerful because I know I was still conscious for it, right? And what I'm referring to is literally the very last breath that I took, the precise transition point from life to death.
Yep.
And the only way that I can describe that feeling is one of absolute and complete surrender to something much greater than ourselves. And through that surrender came an overwhelming sense of peace. It was as if every good, every bad, every positive, every negative just vanished. It's almost as if the spirit became part of everything and nothing at the same time.
Maybe you were like this before, I'm asking this question post, but did this make you religious in any way if you weren't before?
No, it actually, so this is such an important question. You know, in short, back then, remember, this is 10 years ago, yeah. 11 years yeah. ago, hard to believe, it was just 11 years ago, April 21st. I grew up somewhat religious, distanced from it for a lot of different reasons. It was sort of, you know, before this point, it's not like I didn't believe, but I wasn't really very committed to any type of religion. And what was interesting is this experience actually pushed me farther away from it for a very long time. And it wasn't until really over the last couple of years where this took me 10 years to really integrate this experience into my life and derive meaning.
Can't imagine.
We all intuitively know that adverse experiences in our lives can develop us, right? They can make us grow, make us stronger. But the misconception is that growth and transformation occur because of the traumatic experience or the adverse event. When in actuality, that transformative process doesn't occur until some point afterwards, only upon which we've successfully integrated the experience into our lives and derived meaning in it. So it's that transformative journey afterwards that is the real definition of who we are.
So where does that put you today as it relates to being religious or non-religious, or how do you sit?
I would refer to myself as deeply spiritual. And in fact, I'm actually in a master's program right now studying consciousness. Which it's interesting, Mark, I don't align with any specific organized faith, yet I find commonalities between many of them. And the message that I project on stage, like, I respect the many different ways that people find strength and inner peace, right, in their own ways. What this kind of message, this experience tends to do is reinforce people's own sense of faith in whatever that is that they believe in, right? And my thoughts, so much of this ultimately gravitates towards very similar things, which is this concept of surrender, right, to this larger process. Very difficult word for a military guy to use, right?
There is strength, though, in what you just said. There is strength in surrendering. And I think that especially it took me till I was 50 years old till I really figured that out. And especially when I played in a gladiator sport and you're a badass military guy, you know, you're all gunned up and you've been through hell and back, really. And so to kind of take that shield off and put it down and just really understand that, start talking about these different religions. I am of the belief that there's not a right or a wrong. I don't think all the Christians are right and all the Muslims are wrong. I don't know who's right, who's wrong, but the core message between each one of them is this thing called love, right? And that's right. What unifies everything together. And then everything else gets all junked up between governments and politics and all that kind of stuff. But I think that everybody following their own path and not being swayed by influences that aren't innate to what that person believes. And again, where love comes, you've got happiness and you've got cooperation, you've got surrendering, and you've got a lot of things because you have more compassion for your fellow mankind. So That's how I see it, at least.
I definitely very much appreciate that. You know, this love, this allurement towards life, it's interesting to realize the question, where does that come from, right?
Yep.
Where does our ability to create come from? There are so many just deep, deep mysteries that, you know, and I'm a huge fan of integrating the metaphysical and the physical, right? Blending science and metaphysics together. You know, and we should constantly be drawing from the best of all worlds. But I think that only heightens the mystery of it all and heightens the power of all. There's certain things that just cannot be explained. And sometimes what can you do except just sit back in awe over what that is, you know?
Well, okay, so look, I'm sitting back right now doing that awe moment right now of wondering what that was like when you woke up after 15 minutes. You're literally flatlined, clinically dead, and now this life comes back into you. Did your, like, your chest swell and big breath, and now you're alive, and whoa, you know, or were you just groggy and you're coming out of it, and then you realize what happened when people told you? What was that moment like?
Because, you know, when they got the pulse back, I was still unconscious.
Yeah.
Went through a couple of surgeries. It wasn't until about a day and a half, 2 days later that I actually regained full consciousness. And by that point, I was so heavily medicated, like methadone, morphine, Percocet, God only knows what else.
Yeah.
But again, I go back to this. There was almost never any type of celebration or any type of good feeling about that. Yeah. One, you know, first question on my mouth, did Marlon make it? Nope. Yeah. That's what, yeah. Right? Second, now I'm flying back to the United States and on this medical evacuation plane. I'm kind of completely helpless while my men, my team, is still fighting. Right. So that same guilt we talked about at West Point at the beginning of this, It's not like every minute was a minute closer to home on that plane ride. It was a minute farther away from my team. I realize that some people might be like, what are you talking about? You're shot. It doesn't matter. Like, you don't care about your own injuries. So what I would say is, like, that guilt, even though I wasn't cognizant of it or aware of it at the time, the onset of that was almost immediate and took hold almost immediately in a variety of different ways that took nearly 10 years to uncover. It really, truly wasn't until I learned to fully accept the death of my old self before I could learn to live in the present moment again. And that was a journey that took 10 years. You know, it was...
That's actually really a profound statement. Love it. Right. So this podcast literally could go for 3 days. I mean, this is such a fascinating. And what I want to do is I want to talk about this book that you wrote called Darker Souls. I'm putting these words in your mouth, but you've brought up a number of times about the past 10 years of how you've gone through your healing. And is this book the result of that journey that you've been on?
Yeah, the title of the book is called The Beauty of a Darker Soul. And it's about overcoming trauma through the power of human connection. In short, I was, for years and years, I've been pushed by a lot of different people to write a book on this experience. And I never wanted to do that, right? I never wanted to just write a book about a war story. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I knew we had the capacity to leverage this experience for a much greater purpose. And I was able to finally, about 3 years ago, started this process. And certainly the near-death stuff is in there, all that stuff's in there, and it's a nice read in that regard. But the primary purpose of this book is to allow people to look at emotional trauma through a very different lens, through their own lens, in their own ways, and to give people permission to recognize and validate the true source of their emotional pain. A couple different things about trauma. Trauma is not always what it seems, right? It's complex. It's cumulative. It still remains very misunderstood, even within the clinical community, and certainly within larger society as a whole. So this is a foundational work that anyone picking it up, I'd encourage you to read it through your own lens in your own ways. Recovery from our past experiences really begins by recognizing what's there, right? Recognizing the root cause. And it's very easy to get sidetracked and misidentify what that root cause might have been, right?
Yeah.
the beauty of it is that when we do identify that root cause, it's like these powerful emotions like shame and guilt have a big vulnerability, a big weakness. And that begins with shining light upon them. That once it's in the open, once it's uncovered, there's no way to go but up.
Love that. Let me ask you this. I want to tie something back that you just said, which to me was a key word. But when I first asked you about this book in these last 10 years, you tied it back to human connection. Mm-hmm. So what part of that piece did human connection for you help you bring you back to the fold here?
Human connection is really the blanket that envelops all of this, right? It's the relationships that we share between one another that have the capacity to dispel the sense of isolation that accompanies trauma. And this book really draws out some of the profound moments in my life where I truly felt when I was fighting through kind of the deepest, darkest emotional voids, right? Those deep depressive spirals, suicidal spirals. There were moments when I truly believed that no one could possibly understand what I was experiencing. It's a very dangerous, very isolating thing to experience. Yet the common pattern that has emerged as I look back retrospectively is there's always someone there, right?
Yeah.
Whether I was consciously aware of it or not, there's always someone there who had the courage to plant those healing seeds. So as it comes to human connection, people are almost naturally gravitating to look at how people in their lives are impacting them and how they're impacting the lives of others as well. In a gist, right? Trauma doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
It comes in many shapes and forms and impacts all of us from every walk of life. And when we look at it through a deep enough lens, through this lens of the moral, ethical, spiritual realm, which is really where the book goes, that is what gives us the capacity to connect at the very core of the human experience, right? The power and that vulnerability. It's a book that gives people permission to do that, which I find that I think many people are craving, just permission. Validation of what they might be experiencing.
Yeah. So have you ever seen this movie called The Count of Monte Cristo?
I have. It's been a while, but I've seen it.
Yeah. So ironically, Jim Caviezel, who's the main actor in the movie, he was over at my house about a month ago with a couple of my buddies, and we spent half a night just talking about movies and life and Ronald Reagan, and he was doing all kinds of... But I was telling him about this Count of Monte Cristo, and the thing that was interesting, and so for the listener who's not seen that movie, it essentially takes place like back in the 18th century. It's a shipping village, and essentially his buddy turns on him, Jim Caviezel, and he ends up being sentenced to solitary confinement for life on this little island in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of like Alcatraz, and he's in solitary confinement, and then from beneath the floorboards in the stone cell that he was in for years, this old man emerges, and it turns out to be the biggest gift of his life. And it was the biggest gift because he taught him the ways of the world. He's a very wise old man. He taught him about self-defense and language and about math and about currency. Later part of that movie, if you remember, he ends up escaping. And so the blessing for him was the fact that he was in prison for all those years to come out such a better person. And for many years for myself, I've considered myself the Count of Hermosa Beach. And I had moved down from Seattle, some adverse conditions, and I ended up splitting with my ex, and my dad had passed away, and there's a lot of things, but all got back down to that word of isolation for me and about connection. And one of the reasons why I just moved to Sun Valley, Idaho is because I've got a lot of people here that I know and a lot of people that want to involve me back. And so kind of my image of myself and who am I and what's my purpose and all those things, I really had to sort out through that period of time. But as I look back on it too, I look at back, like I would never want to wish the worst upon anybody. And certainly I didn't experience the kind of things that you did. But at the same time, I look at this as such a blessing because it led me into the mountains and it led me into understanding a better serenity about my surroundings, about getting better clarity about where I want to go. I started this podcast. I mean, the blessings I've had of talking to guys like you and women who have shared their story of bravery and overcoming things. It's just been amazing. So when you said that word, it was like a hot button for me about human connection, because at the end of the day, that's what we're all driven to do. We're social creatures. We need to come together. We don't need to isolate. When you do that, I think great things can happen.
Right on.
Where can people find this book?
Best place to go is it's on Amazon, The Beauty of a Darker Soul.
Okay.
And then the website is darkersouls.com. I'm going through a pretty big revamp of my website. I mean, it's still up right now, but just expect some big changes to come over the next 3-4 months.
And what's the name of your website?
Just darkersouls.com.
Okay, great. And you're on the public speaking circuit as well?
Yep, sure am. I'm kind of all over the, you know, when I'm not in grad school or speaking, I'm here doing research and writing and filming right now, getting ready for the next phase of what's about to happen with the company. So basically, this is developing into a company that trains clinicians within the behavioral health field and on a variety of different capacities.
You know, the thing I love about your story is that, again, through this adversity that you've gone through and through this struggle of the last 10 years, you know, you've come out the other side much better. And now you're, it sounds like you're on this very purposeful journey about the things that you've seen and the things you want to change.
We're getting there, right? It's a journey that's constantly unfolding. The key word you use there is journey. If there's anything that I've learned, and it's to maintain the humility to always know that healing and transformation is a journey. It's never a fixed point in time.
Love that. Well, listen, your shirt says support the sacrifice, and certainly I support you and what you've done and what you've given to this country. This pod has been so rewarding for me. I love the storytelling that you went through, and thanks for your patience. We'll put all the stuff in the show notes as it comes up, but again, I totally appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, likewise. I really appreciate it. And it's great to connect with you. This was awesome.
Yeah. All right, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. If you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.